And today is Election Day, November 11th, 24th of Cheshvan. This is the women's Chumash year. We are up to the beginning of Perek Lamed Bet, Parshat Ha'azinu.
Okay, Rabotai. We're going to begin today Perek Lamed Bet, the beginning of Parshat Ha'azinu. And I begin with a very interesting insight provided by Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, the Rav's brother, in trying to explain how and why a Shira is written differently in the Torah than it is than the rest of the text of the Torah. Every single Sefer Torah is written in columns, without fail. And it's perfectly, you know, and that's the task of a Sofer. He's got to figure out, depending on how big he writes, how many words can fit on this line. And if not, he's got to elongate it. It fits into a perfect column.
Not every Sefer Torah has the same words on the line.
That is correct. There is no set requirement that the words Bereshit bara Elohim et Hashemayim et Haaretz be on one line, and the next pasuk start Ve'aretz. There is a tradition that, and not every Sefer Torah comes, but many do, it's called Vavei Ha'amudim. It's a phrase found in Parshat Vayakel, which describes the hooks that attached the ohel, the canvas cover of the Mishkan, to the walls itself. They were called Vavei Ha'amudim. Somebody in our tradition has decided that this should mean Vav, the letter Vav, should be the opening of every column, Amudim. And Amud is a column. And there are many Sifrei Torah that are written so that every single column of the Sefer Torah begins with the letter Vav, with the exception of six. There are six exceptions to the rule. One of them, obviously, is Bereshit. But there are five other additional exceptions to the rule. And many Sifrei Torah, it's considered a Hidur. I don't know why, but it is. And then the Sofer has to, if he's trying to accomplish that, he really has to organize, you know, how he's going to lay it out, so that the last word in column A ends with a word, so that the next word in the text is thought with a Vav. And there are many such Sifrei Torah called Vavei Ha'amodim. But the line, whatever the column is, it's complete. In a poem, there are two different styles in the writing of poetry, in the Torah. One is, as I told you, bricks on top of mortar, where you have something here at the beginning of the line, a blank in the middle of the line, and then some more words at the end of the line. Then the next line, there is only writing in the middle, and the two ends are completely blank. So it looks like you're layering bricks. That's the way the Shira is written. This particular Shira is written differently. It's written in one column or in columns. Only the two ends of the column have something written in it. The middle of the column is completely blank. Completely blank. So it'll read like this. Ha'azinu ha'shamayim ha'aretz, blank. Then at the other end of that column, v'tishma ha'aretz imrefi. And that's the way the entire sheet, Ya'arov kamatar l'kri, blank. Middle is blank. Tizal katal imrasi. And that's how it is. So it's always done that way. And the common denominator in all poems is that there are blanks, as opposed to the rest of the text, where the columns are completely full, and there is only a column because it's supposed to be done neatly. And you can't have things going in and out. You have to write it neatly. And the way to write neatly, every third grade teacher will tell you, keep your lines, your paragraphs in the, you know, in a column, and that's it. But why is it that a Shira is written not in columns? Why are there blanks? So he suggested, because there is a very big difference when you are taught in college or in high school the way to look at prose versus the way you look at poetry. In prose, the assumption is made that the writer is communicating his or her thoughts to you on paper. They're telling you what they have in mind. And at least in theory, the idea intended to be communicated by the writer is supposed to appear in the words. That's what writing is supposed to do. In poetry, the poet does not necessarily reveal to you what precisely was running through his or her mind. It creates certain images, and as a result of those images, it enables and challenges us to think, what was she talking about? What did she have in mind? And as a result, it's subject to much interpretation and to much personal, how you read it is how you feel about it. That's the difference between a poem and prose, where something is written black on white. I'm telling you what's happening in the story. Shira in the Torah is supposed to be the exact same thing. It is deliberately written in this fashion because it wants the reader, you and me, to be able to interject and to place our thoughts as to how we understand what is unfolding in this text. So although I have encouraged you, and I believe it's correct, that we have a role in understanding every single text that we come across, and to challenge, there are things which are even written in the prose where we've seen, what exactly does this he mean? Does it talk? What does the Ramban mean? And so on and so forth. And we have an opportunity in poetry form, it's even a greater challenge and a greater responsibility for us to be able to contribute what we see as legitimate through our eyes. Now, not everybody likes to hear what I'm saying. I gave a session last week. There was a junior high school conference, an elementary school conference in Kushner. A lot of the schools were off last week on Election Day. So I gave a presentation on, here was what it was, teaching Gemara to 7th and 8th grade, to junior high school students, : are we underestimating the ability of our students? And my feeling always has been, from the perspective of a high school principal, that I think that elementary school teachers, at least in terms of Gemara, water it down to such a point that they basically translate the text without really thoroughly challenging them and to begin to cultivate the process of conceptual analytical thinking. And I think that 7th and 8th graders are capable of becoming, of beginning that process. And that's why so many of them are bored. You know, they listen to it once and that's it. The Rebbe's repeating it 8 times because of the fact, right? Exactly, repeating it 8 times because he heard it. Right, so that's what. So in my presentation, I used the following words. And I gave them a couple of illustrations. How you read a Gemara and Tosafot will ask a question based on another source. That's Tosafot's style. You see something here, you see something else that challenges, that it opposes it, you ask the question. Now, Tosafot, Rabbeinu Tam, and others, they knew the Gemara someplace else. That was their genius, that was their ability. They had all of Shas on their fingertips and were able to say, how does the Gemara say A, something else that says B? I don't expect anybody in today's time, not only an elementary school, not a high school kid, not even a Beis Medrash kid, to be able to know everything. But once you show them that other source, I believe that 9 out of 10 kids will be able to identify Tosafot's question. As long as you set it up properly, you show them this source, Now you show them the other source, right? Today with the smart board, it's so easy, right? You flash up on the board, you see the two sources right next to each other, and they're right. Go ahead, you are now the Rabbeinu Tam. And I use the word, and we are going to attack Rashi. Attack Rashi. And this one guy comes over after the session, so excellent session, yeah, I teach this 8th grade in one of the local schools, I don't want to identify it, which one? He says, but how do you use the word attack to boys? How do you use that word? You're not Rashi. Rabbeinu Tam, he can ask such a question. But your kids, they're not Mishainu. How do you ask such a question, tell them to attack? I said, well, the answer is, I believe you have a right to attack. That your job is to understand it the same way. And you can do the same thing. You can be the next Paleotosis. That's what I tell you. You're the next Tosis. You're the next Ramban. Because you see the way they were thinking. The difference is that the Ramban had his whole arsenal in his fingertips. He didn't have Bar Ilan, you know, the whole thing on his finger. He didn't have all that. He had it right up here. So when he saw something, oh, that binds me to some other Masechta, this Samachta, says something different. That I can't expect. So the challenge is to become involved, and I invite your comments even more so in Hapro. That's why he suggested there are blanks. Because the blanks in the text are designed to be filled in by the reader. By you and me, as we read the poetry, we are supposed to fill in those blanks. And this idea is communicated by designing the writing of the Torah in such a fashion where every single pasuk has a little margin for you to put your note, your comment, your understanding, what exactly did Moshe Rabbeinu mean when he said this particular parsha? Yes?
Without detracting from that, but just to look at a much simpler explanation, since you've emphasized that all the Shira is meant to be memorized, sung, spoken out.
Correct.
This indicates the call and response form, where one person will be saying the first part, and the audience, those listening, will answer with the second.
Excellent. Excellent. Now, excellent point that Shira is often poetry's design. There is a reader who prompts. Now, in relationship to Shirat Moshe, we see that. Moshe says, Ashiru Lashem, Shiru Lashem ki ga'o ga'a, right? And Am Yisrael will answer, Sus v'roch vo Rama Bayam. Does anybody know when we ever do such a thing in davening? Every time there's a bris. There's a bris. We have a minhag to recite the Zecharot Imo and the Shira. So the Moel takes the lead, and he starts it. Right? Ashur Hashem Ki Ga'o Ga. We respond. Sus Varocha Rama Vayam. He says, Micha Mocha Bayla Hashem Ga'o. We respond. No Rati Hilot O Sefela. That's the way it's done in every single Shira, and it's done on Parshas B'Shalach as well. Here, it's a good point. We don't see it as much with Hazinu, but your point is well taken, no doubt. And it's designed for poetry to be sung, to be memorized by heart. Because song is much easier to memorize, and it also stirs your emotion much more so than a simple paragraph. So let's begin. It's very difficult. Yes?
Can't that get a little dangerous for certain sects of Jewry trying to rewrite
or
put their own understanding in?
I understand. But we recognize that there are some limitations, but the creativity, I have never had a problem with it, creativity of understanding what the author is trying to tell us. Moshe Rabbeinu, any Ba'atolish Marfu. As long as we don't say that, it's a two office, or something like that. But there's no monopoly on Torah knowledge. No monopoly. Somebody once asked Ravon Lichtenstein, is it possible that Milton in Paradise Lost had better insight to God's creation of the world than the Ramban did in when he wrote his comments to Masa Bereshis? Ravon's response, I wouldn't dismiss the possibility a priori, It's possible that Milton saw something that the Ramban didn't see. It's possible. Okay. Lama Yang. Okay. Now, the Shira itself, this Hazinu, will cover several thousand years of Jewish history. There are parts of this Hazinu which will harp on familiar themes of Moshe bringing up the times that we did this wrong, did that wrong, did this wrong, and that God punished and punished and punished. And he warns them, this is going to happen again, as we've seen constantly. There are also sections of prophetic vision, what's going to happen until Yemot HaMashiach. That's also contained in Parshat Ha'azinu. So, and it'll be, we'll have to try to establish, what section begins at what. And all I can tell you is that the first three psukim, which we will read, is a much broader introduction to the entire unit, though in itself, Pasuk Gimel is debated whether it belongs to the first two psukim, or Pasuk Gimel is the introduction to the next one. So we'll see. Ha'azinu ha-shamayim va'adavera v'tishma ha'aretz imrefi. Please, heavens, listen, and I will speak. V'tishma ha'aretz imrefi. And may the earth listen as I come forth with my words. There are obviously synonyms, ha'azinu and tishma. However, there is a different word. And we'll see as to whether or not there's any significance to the selection of ha'azana, ozen, for what? For shamayim, and shmi'a, for aretz, in a second. But the significance of shmayim aretz has already been given away by Rashi earlier. But there will be several other additions today. What did Rashi say? The witnesses that I am going to summon, that I indeed warned you that you have an obligation to observe the covenant, 200 years from now, 500 years from now, who will serve as those witnesses? Heaven and earth. That's the way Rashi learned. Why am I summoning Shemayim and Aretz? Because they are going to be called forth as the witnesses to prove, yes, you were warned by Moses that there is a covenant which you pledged to observe, and now you're violating it, and therefore you deserve X, Y, and Z. As to how we will see in Rashi in a couple of minutes, how heaven and earth offer their testimony. Yes.
Because I did have a problem with this a couple of weeks ago when you spoke about this before. Because you're talking right before that, you spoke about how with Avodah Zarah that Bnei Yisrael were very involved in like worshiping Shemayim Ba'aretz, basically.
Correct.
So then, right after you rebuke them for that, then you say that Shemayim and Aretz are going to be witnesses. It's like you make them into little mini deities.
No, but they're not deities at all. They are only here to serve prosecutors. That's all. The sun, the moon, everything have their role. They are God's instruments. They don't deserve to be worshipped. They don't deserve any praise. But they are God's servicemen to do things on this world. One of the instruments, one of their tasks, one of their charges as God's instrument is to serve as a witness to condemn Am Yisrael. But even though I hear with your point, We're singling them out, even though we're being critical of those who worship them. This is not intended to worship. We don't worship a witness. That's one of their tasks, especially the witness who condemns you. That's not somebody who prays and worships. These are coming forth only to serve, and we'll see how they give forth their testimony. So I just want to read the Rashi, and then I'll share with you a couple of other perspectives. Take a look at Rashi. Ha'azinu Hashemayim. Sha'ani matre bahem b'Yisrael v'tihiyu edim b'davar. I am going to warn through them and they will serve as witnesses. Shekach amarti lahem she'atem tihiyu edim. I have already told them that they are going to be witnesses. We read it 20 times in Parshas Vayelech, right? Ha'idoti bachem ha'shamayim va'aretz. We saw it 20 times. So here is the formal announcement. It's like at the wedding, after you call up the person who is going to be Masada Kedushin, what comes next? Who are going to be the Eidei Kedushin? Right? It's customary today. It's not necessary. It's customary to designate this person and this person have been designated as Eidei Kedushin. Here too, Shamayim and Aretz are here being by being designated, you are the witnesses. V'chein v'tishma ha'aretz. V'lama he'id bohem Shamayim v'aretz. Why did Moshe select heaven and earth to serve as his two witnesses? Amar Moshe, it's very simple. Ani basar v'adam. I am made out of flesh and blood like everybody else. L'machar, tomorrow, ani meit, I'm going to die tomorrow. Im yomru Yisrael lo kibalnu aleinu habrit, if ever a person will come forth from Am Yisrael and say, I never accepted the obligations of the covenant, mi ba'u makhisham, who will be around to contradict them when they're lying in their face? Lefikach, therefore, he'id bahem shemayim va'aretz, edim shehem kayamim le'olam. Witnesses that will always be around, therefore I select heaven and earth to serve as my witness. That's number one, says Rashi. V'od, and now I'll take a quick thing in a second, v'od, then Rashi tells us, how do I have evidence that Shemayim and Aretz are offering testimony? Up until now, you can look at Shemayim and Aretz as just being images. It's a nice little idea. But Shemayim and Aretz don't talk. So when Moshe says, I'm going to call upon them to be my witnesses, he doesn't really expect them to give forth any testimony. Now Rashi's going to say no. Shemayim and Aretz have the capacity to give us their testimony through some of their actions. Let's read. The Ode. She'im yizku, if they will be deserving of it, yavo'u ha'edim v'yitnu scharam. The witnesses will now come and offer your reward. Ha'gefen titein piriyah. The vine will give off its produce, grapes. The ha'aretz titen yivula, and the ground will sprout forth its produce. We'll have grain, wheat, and so on and so forth. The ha'shamayim yitnu tlam, and the heavens will give off what? Their due. The im yischaivu, and if the witnesses should find that you are not complying, Tihiyeh bohem yad ha'edim tchila. What did the Torah tell us in Parshat Shofim, in chapter 17 of Sefer Dvarim? That when you have to stone somebody, who throws the first rocks? The witnesses. Yad ha'edim tihiyeh bo barishona. Here too. The witnesses will be the ones who will administer the punishment. How? The atzar et hashamayim v'lo yeh matar. We say it every day. When there is drought, when the earth does not produce a sufficient produce, and there is famine, that heaven, the witness, and earth, the witness, telling you, we had it in Tyra, you were proven guilty, and here I am talking and fulfilling the mandate, yad ha'edim tihiyeh bo barishona. The witness should be the first one to administer punishment. V'yat kol ha'am ba'achrona. Then everybody else joins in. Here too, first thing is Shemayim and Aretz. So Rashi gives a second idea that it's not just that they are witnesses, but there are witnesses who have the capacity to let you and me know what exactly they're saying. What precisely they are saying. That if they are talking in the positive, then they will respond. If they see that Am Yisrael are not deserving, they will offer their testimony and indicate it through that. That's perspective number one. Yes?
What is a bat kol? Is that related to
this? This has nothing to do with a bat kol. I can't explain what a bat kol, I can just tell you what it means. It means that heaven, a voice coming down from heaven. I have no idea what it means. Maybe you've heard some before. I haven't been privileged. I don't know what it means. But the Gemara talks about bat kol. voices from heaven, and in halachic sense, we were told to ignore them. Ignore any heavenly, about a decree, about the halachas like this guy and halachas like, just ignore them. Take a vote, and whatever we say is the halacha. Yes?
Whether Moshe's alive or not, it's Hashem's judgment whether we're listening or not. So it's almost implying that Hashem needs witnesses.
That's correct.
Disrespectful.
No, because HaKadosh Baruch Hu is operating with the rules of the game. You claim that what, in theory, you're 100% right. HaKadosh Baruch Hu doesn't have to, but as a judge, he plays by the rules of the game, and what is a judge's primary responsibility? To be impartial. Right? Even though he may know what the person's guilty. The judge, when he hears the case, has to be impartial. And therefore he summons these witnesses. Lo ya'aseh mishpat. Yes?
So the Shemayim Va'aretz was created on the first day, so it's symbolic that they should be the witnesses.
Good, that brings me to my next point. Others claim that there is a different significance to establishing Shemayim Va'aretz. Does anybody remember the famous Midrash quoted in Masechet Shabbat, cited on the Pasuk in Parshat Yitro, where the Torah says, Vayitzvu tachat hahar. They were standing underneath the mountain. Correct. What do you mean standing underneath the mountain at Sinai? Correct. So the Midrash quotes, the Gemara quotes, the Midrashi quotes it, Melame shikafa aleim har kigid. He raised Mount Sinai and he tells them, you know what? You know what? If you accept the Torah, fine. If not, you're going to be buried here. You're going to be buried. In other words, the entire purpose of creation and existence is to do one thing. Follow through on the Torah. If you choose to abandon Torah, you forfeit your right to what? To exist. That's the imagery. I will bury you here. You will be buried. Shom tehei tvurachem. This is where you will be buried. The other midrash. Histakel be'oraita ubara alma. God looked into the Torah and then created the world. Nice little midrash. What does it mean? The Torah preceded the world. God looks at the Torah and then he creates the world. It means he is creating the world for a purpose. Purpose of the world's creation is to ultimately have a nation of Israel who will accept the Torah, and that nation will now illuminate the responsibilities of every citizen on this planet. So the reason why, a second possibility, why Shemayim and Aretz are mentioned here at the beginning is because Shemayim and Aretz represent the beginning of creation. And he's telling them, if you will commit to the Torah, your creation will have been justified. If you don't commit to the Torah, then this is where you're going to be buried. It's not worth having created the world unless somebody were to go ahead and be prepared to accept the Torah, and therefore Shemayim and Aretz as the signal. Keep in mind, it reminds you of the first pasuk in the Chumash, the Reishit bara Elohim et Hashemayim et Aretz. Why did God create Shemayim and Aretz? So that we follow His commandments. You choose not to follow His commandments, there's nothing but utter destruction. So the second possible explanation for Shemayim and Aretz is not that they are being summoned as witnesses. We mention them at the outset of the poem to remind us of the first Shemayim and Aretz that appear in the Torah text, and that we should be aware of the disastrous consequences that will be generated as a result of the fact that I choose to abandon. That's a second possibility.
But that doesn't account for the Ha'azinu.
That is correct. You're right. I grant you that, 100%. Third Pas, yes.
Doesn't it create a worship of a concept of worshiping heaven and earth?
No, that's what Gila just asked.
That's why I like your second explanation.
No. The answer is no. It doesn't. Because...
pray to them to not do this.
No, but you have no... You can't pray to a witness who... You can't plead with a witness. Witnesses are here, but...
it's illegal.
That's witness tampering. That's witness tampering. Third possibility, that Shemayim and Aretz is mentioned here because ultimately we're talking to you and me. And you and me are comprised of two sections, two parts. There is a body, a goof, which is created from Aretz, and each and every one of us has a neshama that is taken from heaven above. So Rabbeinu Bachya, for example, says, Ha'azinu Hashemayim Va'aretz is not heaven and earth. It's not summoning any witnesses. Who is Moshe's remark opening, whose opening remark directed to? To the people. But I'm telling you people that you have both phenomenon. You are comprised of a nefesh and a guf. And I know what happens in this tug of war, who is going to dominate. Will the goof dominate, in which case your entire existence is only used to what? To solve the needs, to fulfill the needs, pleasures of the body? Or are you going to be able to be capable of recognizing that your existence, your body, has the capacity to somehow link itself to some type of spiritual phenomenon which it draws from heaven, in which case your life takes on a totally different perspective? Not that you don't eat, not that you don't sleep, not that you don't play ball and root for the Yankees. You do all of that. But there's got to be a higher objective. There's got to be a more divine purpose for life. In which case, he is not summoning heaven and earth. He is summoning you and me. Correct. In both aspects. Because you cannot just be heavenly. That's what an angel is. An angel only has one dimension. He is a spiritual entity, whatever that means. But that's, we're not expected to be angels. We're expected to be human beings who have the capacity to introduce sanctity into the world, the physical world. Yes.
That would actually account for the two verbs, because ha'azinu is active, listen, and lishmoa is passive, hear. So if you listen with your spiritual component, your physical component will also hear.
Very good. No doubt. Excellent. Very nice. Very nice. That's a third possibility.
Who said that?
Rabbeinu Bachya. Bachya ibn Pekuda. There is a fourth possibility as to why he begins with Shemayim and Aretz. I told you that Parashat Ha'azinu is going to cover several thousand years of history. Several thousand years. He is going to make reference, according to many, to the Avot. In Pasuk, Pasuk Zion. Zechor Yemot Olam. So he's now going to remind us of Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. Very nice. So if I'm going to be in reminding you of focusing on several thousands of years of history, where do we start? Correct. We're going to be starting with the creation of the world. And I will take you until the end of time, Yemot HaMashiach. So another explanation as to why Ha'azinu Hashemayim V'aretz begins, because the scope of the subject matter of this particular parsha is from the beginning of the creation of the world, Shamayim and Aretz, until Yemot HaMashiach, which we don't know when they will take place. But the purpose of Shamayim and Aretz is simply to let you know that the entire gamut of history will be touched upon in this particular unit right here. Right here. Now, in terms of Ha'azinu versus Tishma. So, who says, Yes. Ibn Ezra, Chizkuni and Ibn Ezra point out, particularly Chizkuni, that the word Ha'azana is, as opposed to Tishma, requires real listening. You have to make it, make an effort to listen. What do you think is the root of the word ha'azinu? It's an ozen. That's correct. La'azin, yes. But it's ozen. That's a good question. Right. Because you have to give your ear away in order to what? You have to pay attention. When something is right next to you, you don't have to have what? Much. You have to pay special attention. You're going to hear. Therefore, he says, in order to listen to Shamayim, when heaven will offer its testimony, it's ha'azinu. You better pay careful attention. It's harder to read its signals. It's a much greater distance. If it represents the spirit, it's harder to get in touch with your spirit. V'tishma ha'aretz, it's right down here on earth. Shmi'ah is something that is, you just hear, whether or not you're paying much attention to it, you can hear it. It's far easier to hear, to be attuned to what? To what is taking place here on earth, to your body, to our physical life, than it is to heaven bound, and consequently, he uses that type of expression. Ha'azinu ha'shamayim, v'tishma ha'aretz. Imrei fi.
Right, yes. Another meaning to the word ha'azana, which means a balancing, and I don't know where that comes.
But that's moznayim. That's moznayim.
Right, exactly. But ha'azana is a balancing.
Okay, that's good because every doctor will tell you that when you when you're dizzy, it's because you have an inner ear infection, right? I was machadis, a great medical phenomenon. So your balance is related to your hearing.
In modern
yes.
Court does in balancing the argument.
That's good.
But I don't. I'm not
but that doesn't fit into here. It doesn't. Yeah.
There's also a difference between listening and hearing. I mean, you can hear, but not listening.
That's correct. That's correct.
Maybe, I'm just thinking that maybe Hazino is listening. And what you talked before about the neshama being part of the spiritual, that that's harder to
hear.
Yeah.
Right.
And maybe that's why shamayim, hazinu shamayim, it takes more effort.
Right. But on the other hand, how could you have claimed that vitishma does not simply mean to hear?
No, because...
Give me a pasuk in the Torah where the word shma has nothing to do with hearing.
Shma Yisrael.
Shma Yisrael doesn't mean to hear.
Yeah.
It means to understand. To comprehend. So it could very well be that these distinctions between ha'azana and shmiya are very artificial, because in both cases, what does it really mean? To pay careful attention. So much so that you internalize it. Tishma ha'aret, I want you to internalize, make it part of you, imrefi. Good. So we have the scene, shamayim and aretz. One more thing is necessary to complete the entire package. The introduction. I have heaven and earth. Physical creation of the world. And what did we say is the driving force of legitimizing the creation? Torah. Next pasuk refers to Torah. Ya'arov kamatal likhi tizal katal imrati kisi'irim aleideshe the Chirvivim Alei Esev. Almost everybody defines this pasuk as Moshe's subject matter, referring to the body of Torah. And the body of Torah is which provides chiyut, life. Consequently, he compares the Torah to something that is absolutely indispensable for the survival of life. What is indispensable for the survival of life? Water. Ya'arof kamatar likhi. And how does the English translation go? Ya'arof. What word does he choose?
Drop.
To drop. Okay. Drop. Drop. Like rain, my words, drop. Okay, it's interesting. Make my teaching drop like rain. Okay. And tizal katal imrati, let my words drip like dew. Yeah. Now, let's take a look at Rashi. And you'll see, Rashi himself, he paves the way for everybody else. That is correct. Ya'arov kamata likri. Zu yahidus shete'idu. This is the basis of the testimony that you, heaven and earth, shall testify. Sha'ani omer bifnechem. Torah natati li Yisrael shehi chayim la'olam. I have given my Torah to the world, to Am Yisrael, which would ultimately now provide life for the entire world. Kamatar ze shu chayim liolam, like water, like rain, which provides life for the entire world. Ka'ashe ya'arfu hashamayim talumatar. Says Rashi, ya'arof lashon nitifa, which means to drop. Rashi doesn't say it means to throw down or to what was the word that you said?
Drip.
Drip. To drop. Right, nitifa is a drop. Okay, fine. But then Rashi points out, what is the added accomplishment? What does he accomplish by switching from rain to dew? Kamatar to tizal katal imrati, says Rashi. Tizal katal, shahakol smechimbo. There is nobody who could ever complain about the fact that dew is visited upon this earth. Nobody. Why not? Never gets into anybody's way. It can never interfere with any activity. It can never turn out to be a curse. It could never be something that you would pray to God, stop it! It's too much! It's disastrous! Whereas lefi shahamatar yesh shehen atzavim, there are people who are very sad. Atzav means sad when it rains. For example, kigon holchei durachim, people who are traveling, they don't like it when it rains. In fact, the Mishnah in Ta'anit tells us what. And even more powerfully, yes, Tana, I'll get to that Friday night in a second, even more powerfully, when in Eretz Yisrael do we start asking for rain? V'tein talu matal v'racha, when? 2 weeks after Sukkot. You start saying, Mashiv haruach ha-moed ha-geshem on Shmini Atzeret, which is the praise that God is responsible, but the request for rain is delayed 2 weeks. Why 2 weeks? Because people are traveling home from Yerushalayim after Sukkot. And Chazal estimated that the furthest point from the northern or southern tips of Israel to the center of the city of Yerushalayim is 2 weeks travel maximum. So God knows, the Halacha knows, you're going to save a Saint Talum Matul Levracha, then you're going to brochure about it when it does rain, because you're traveling with your little pitchers and it's raining. So there are times that rain is not terribly desirable. Or, Mishahaya Boro Malay Mayayim. Somebody had dug a pit, and what was done? He already had what? Harvested his grapes. He crushed them. the well is, the pit is not full of water, he's not interested in having a rain that day. So matar sometimes is beneficial, sometimes is not beneficial. That's why when we make the request for rain, it's always v'tein talu matar livracha. And but we say it every day. Now, anybody who davens a dot hamizrach, anybody, when the chazan says mashiv aruch amarid hageshem, what does the kahal call out? Livracha. Every single Eidot HaMizrach community. Livracha.
Every day?
Every day. Shachris, Mincha, whenever it is Chazaras Hashem. Livracha. Why? Because Marid HaGeshem is not always a bracha. Yeah.
Can the Tal Matar also be corresponding to the Shamayim Ba'aretz? Because the Tal is coming from the Aretz and the Matar is coming from the...
Excellent.
Yeah.
Yes. Very much so. Very good. Matar clearly comes from where? From Shamayim. The dew, it's you don't see, you don't feel dew falling from heaven. It's something which is noticeable only al ha'aretz. Very good, very good. So both of these somehow are now designed for one thing. Heaven and earth, you have one thing to check. Are they compliant with Torah or not? That's it. It's a very simple idea. Very simple idea. What a question. Yeah. Very simple. And then the others are just other adjectives to do the same thing. And Rashi says, Tisseirim alei desha, v'chirivivim alei esev. Again, how does the translation read? Tisseirim? Like storm winds over what?
On vegetation.
On vegetation. The winds, when they blow, that's how Rashi learns, blow si'ara, as if it was written with a samach, not with a sin. Si'ara, storm winds. The winds come and blow and give life to the grass. The chirivivim, and what does he translate the chirivivim?
Raindrops.
Also raindrops. Aliyah, good.
Says
Ruach, Kiruchei Mitra. 100%. That's how Rashi interprets. Many believe that Si'irim has nothing to do with rain,
yeah.
Nothing to do with wind,
yeah.
But it's a Sa'ir. Si'irim, what is that? A goat. What in the world? Sa'ir la'azazel. What is happening here? What imagery is being created here? Kisi'irim alei desha. What's the imagery being created? So some claim, I'm not saying it's the pshat, but some claim, the sa'ir, think about the phrase that we say every single Yom Tov. Umin chatam v'niskehem kimidubar. Shlosha esronim lapar. Shnei esronim la'ayil. The sa'ir, lechaper, ushnei temidim, kihil chatam. V'sa'ir l'chaper. That when you bring the korban, the little addition is reminding you that you always have to bring a little goat. For what purpose? As a korban chatas, to seek atonement on behalf of Am Yisrael. The Gemara speaks of shnei masar si'irim of Rosh Chodesh. That there are 12 si'irim that the korban musaf had on Rosh Chodesh, had a sa'ir l'chaper. Because of the moon, whatever it is, you know, because it was complaining that we don't need 2 liters, whatever it is. So what's the imagery now comparing Torah to what? To a little goat walking over the grass. What is it supposed to, if the sa'ir is supposed to remind you of kapara, what is the imagery if I'm telling you we're talking about Torah? Correct. Correct. When one engages in transgression, Lidor Dorot, there may not be a Beit HaMikdash. You will not have the opportunity to offer your Sa'ir L'chaper. What is the way to counter transgression, inappropriate behavior? Study, study, and study. More study, and more study. That is the antidote. And it happens to be that which is unique to Am Yisrael. To Am Yisrael. The challenge to engage in sophisticated textual study does not exist in Catholicism. They don't want the lay person to study the text. They don't want it. That's reserved only for whom? For the cleric. That's it. The lay person is not supposed to, you just follow what we tell you to do. We don't believe that. Every person has the right and the opportunity to approach the text. So if a person would like to have a medium of kakara, today, the most perfect antidote, the most best way of kapara is to delve into Torah, uchirivim alei esav. So we've now set the stage. Moshe has his witnesses. He has the essence of what he's telling the witnesses. You are to gauge their behavior. And then we'll continue next of all how Moshe begins his attack. And it's an attack initially, and then how he moves into the prophetic vision with recognition that Pasuk Gimel can either be the closing of this unit or the opening of the next unit. We will continue next Shabbat.